Hello, and welcome to Rational Security, the Wingnuts and Wingmen edition. I'm Shane Harris of the Daily Beast, here with my wingnuts.
We're your wingmen.
You're my wingmen. My wingmen and women. My wing persons. My wing persons. Yeah. Benjamin Wittes. Hello, Ben.
Hey.
Noted wingnut.
I'm not a wingnut.
No, you're just an apologist.
I'm an apologist.
You're a handmaiden, of power.
Handmaiden of power.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. Tamara Kaufman Wittes. Wing woman. Hello, Tamara.
And a little bit nutty, too.
Susan Hennessy, not at all nutty.
Not at all nutty.
Very wingy. Lovely wings on you.
Beautiful wings.
Yes, beautiful wings. Spread your wings and fly. So speaking of wingnuts and wingman, Ted Cruz released his list of foreign policy advisors today. We like to do a little campaign update at the top of the show. And there's some wingy people on this list.
I think we can have real confidence in Frank Gaffney as an advisor to a potential president.
The
most notable thing about the list is the pairing of wingnuts with non-wingnuts, right?
right.
If it was just a wingnut list, you'd be like, oh, all right, well, he's crazy and he takes advice from crazy people. But like, how these people are interacting with one another, how you would even be able to take advice across the spectrum of people.
Mm-hmm.
Well, look, it's not unprecedented for advisors with differing views, sometimes wildly differing views, to advise the same candidate. But typically that's when you have a large group or, you know, and this collection, which includes Elliot Abrams on the one hand and Michael Ledeen and Frank Gaffney on the other, seems to be, well, I guess I would say two things. Number one, maybe an indicator that at least some members of the Republican foreign policy establishment, i.e. Elliot Abrams, are willing to sign up with Cruz. But on the other hand, that, you know, there's not going to be any ideological coherence on foreign policy in this campaign, and maybe it just reflects the broader debate within the Republican Party.
But I think it's fair for somebody like Elliot Abrams, if you're part of the Never Trump crowd.
Is he part of the Never Trump crowd?
Well, I don't know if he's ever used the hashtag, but if you're somebody who is really, really offended by Trump and a conservative, I could see saying it is of paramount importance to deny the nomination to Trump. There is really one option left for doing it. And if we believe that that person is going to be president, shouldn't they have the benefit of establishment foreign policy advice rather than hearing, or in addition to hearing, from Frank Gaffney and Ledeen? By the way, I want to say that, you know, all lawfarers have a deep and abiding beef with Frank Gaffney, which
we
is that
indeed.
If you go to the site lawfare.com or lawfare.org,
which you should not do,
instead of lawfareblog.com,
which you should do
always every day,
you will find yourself at Frank Gaffney's website.
Frank Gaffney's Islamophobic website.
Yes.
Right. So, and particularly hateful.
Right.
Frank Gaffney website.
Please take a moment when this happens to you by accident, sort of like when I used to go to whitehouse.com by accident.
Sure. For research.
When it was a porn site.
It's not anymore?
No, I don't think it's been shut down.
Haven't checked lately.
Hold on.
And, you know, you'll go there and take a moment to pause and bemoan the fate of Lawfare, which has tried and tried and tried to get Frank Gaffney to part with that URL and has so far never gotten the courtesy of a response.
Well, maybe if President Cruz gets elected and Frank Gaffney gets a senior position in the administration, he'll let the website go.
Yeah, that would
maybe
be of cold comfort.
The silver
comfort.
Lining.
Yeah.
Look, but how much do you think is actually about getting advice from your advisors versus using your advisors to signal things to certain groups of people?
Let's ask the presidential advisor
exactly.
on the panel.
I'm looking at you, Tammy.
Okay, but I think that's why it's so interesting that you have what seems like a motley collection of people signed up with the Cruz campaign. Because what are you signaling? You're signaling that your campaign embodies a set of ideological crises of identity within the Republican Party on foreign policy. Oh, that's a great message.
Right. And I think there's something about having wildly different views, sure, but then there's having wild views. And Frank Gaffney, in addition to being a noted Islamophobe, has also been a major funder of research into the theory that the financial collapse of 2008 was the result of Muslim terrorists engaging in the sale of in short selling of stocks.
Wow.
Like, I mean, you've seen these things get peddled around in journalist circles a bit of these really wild kind of stories. And, you know, in the belief that, like, it's one thing to believe that the administration is, like, selling out the Middle East to Iran. It's another thing to think that, like, you know, the banks were crashed by Iranian-sponsored terrorists who, like, read The Big Short or something.
Wouldn't
I guess they wouldn't have read The Big Short by then.
You know what I mean?
Like, quants, terrorist quants.
Yeah. Wouldn't you love to be in a fly on the wall in the Elliot Abrams, Frank Gaffney discussion?
Actually,
I would.
I would. Sitting there with my little fly-sized martini.
My desire to be a fly is pretty limited, actually, on or off the wall.
Oh, all right. More to come on that one. Donald Trump, by the way, notably still not as revealed.
But
his short list.
He consults with himself.
He did say that.
Because he has a very good brain.
Wow.
A
big
great
one.
Brain.
A great, it's huge.
A big, giant
beautiful
brain.
Straw hair.
Do you know what that made me think of, that line? It made me think of Winnie the Pooh, who is a bear of very little brain.
But a lot of heart.
I never thought I would compare Donald Trump and Winnie
their
the
hair,
Pooh, but today did it for
their
me.
Their hair, their fur is the same color.
And Lewandowski is like Piglet. There's a lot of things. This is a rich metaphor. We'll work on it. Next week on National Security.
There's some kind of pig going on there. Anyway. All right. This week on the show, President Obama nominates Merrick Garland to the Supreme Court. Merrick Garland, stealth national security justice judge.
Not really so stealth.
Yeah. An American ISIS defector is in Kurdish custody, and major U.S. websites have been delivering malware to their readers, plus, as always, object lessons. So let's start with just like the big news of the day, of the week. President Obama has nominated Merrick Garland, chief judge of the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. We thought that maybe this nomination would go absolutely nowhere, whoever the president picked, but in Garland, he has picked someone who has earned the praise of conservatives in the past, is one of the more well-regarded, well-liked, well-respected judges on the bench by conservatives and liberals. And we're even starting to see some cracks now in this Republican sort of, you know, barrier where they're saying maybe now we'll consider him in a lame duck session if Hillary Clinton wins.
Well, and a half dozen have said that they will meet with him.
Right.
Despite earlier declared intention
that none
not to
would.
Do so.
Right.
Right, including Chuck Grassley.
Right.
Right, chairman of the Judiciary Committee. So, Ben, you had like a really a good piece on this on Lawfare, but...
Actually,
you know,
can I just say that Ben called the Merrick Garland nomination?
You did call the Merrick Garland nomination.
He did.
I called it the afternoon that Scalia died, actually. Not as a predictive matter, but just as a normative matter, that I thought it was the right answer to the problem created by Scalia's death. And it actually seems to be something like the logic of what Obama did, which is, you know, put somebody forward who is so moderate that it would make the other side look completely unreasonable not to move him, and see if you can develop cracks in the apparent brick wall by doing so.
But isn't just making them seem unreasonable? In some way, I think he's putting, it's not just optics, he's putting a real test to them. He's saying, all right, I'm putting someone before you who is almost certainly better than you'll get from Hillary Clinton, in sort of in terms of the ideological acceptability, and probably is better than what you would get from Trump, who's almost certain to sort of nominate a friend or sort of some unknown commodity. You know, so I think that right now the Republicans really have to ask themselves, all right, you know, sort of where are we in the election cycle? What is the odds that they get, that somebody gets elected who gives them a better candidate?
It's also, I think, it was a choice for the White House how they wanted to use this issue to help Democrats frame a case in the campaign. And there were two ways to do it. One was to put up, you know, a liberal standard bearer that Democrats could rally around and say, you have to elect us so we can get this person on the court. And the other way to do it was to put somebody up who's so incredibly qualified and reasonable that it just makes the Republicans look 100% obstructionist for the sake of being obstructionist. And they went for the latter choice. So it's an appeal to the center, not an appeal to the base. And I think that was an interesting choice. And I also think, I wonder how congressional Democrats who are going to be running on this issue, feel about that choice.
So, you know, we had a, I think for purposes of rational security listeners, you know, the interesting feature of Merrick Garland is how much experience he has in the areas of concern to this podcast. You know, we had a debate on Lawfare recently. One of our contributors wrote in this essay that basically said, hey, we need a national security expert on the Supreme Court. It's a real deficiency of the current crop of nine justices that, you know, none of them, with the sort of limited exception of Elena Kagan, has any real experience in this area. And another person, Adam Klein, who actually clerked for Justice Scalia relatively recently, wrote a response that said, actually, you don't really need a national security expert. It's really much more important to have, you know, a first-rate generalist who's, you know, got an appropriate sort of philosophical orientation and knows how to, you know, do his job. And I think what's interesting about Merrick Garland is he really is both. That this is somebody who, you know, has 19 years of experience on the bench as a sort of very highly regarded judge, but who also, from the point of view of our listenership, is somebody who has a lot of sort of granular experience in the national security space. This is somebody who's run a major counterterrorism investigation and prosecution, the Oklahoma City case. This is also somebody who was served at the senior levels of the Justice Department at a time when the Justice Department was really, you know, reorganizing to some degree in to deal with sort of post-Cold War terrorism issues and sort of the merging of kind of law enforcement and intelligence in some areas. And this is somebody whose career on the D.C. Circuit happens to coincide with a period in which the D.C. Circuit had 20-plus major Guantanamo cases, a series of military commission cases, and a whole bunch of civil lawsuits that implicated national security concerns to one degree or another. And so I was trying to think yesterday sort of like, what's the universe of people you could possibly appoint to the Supreme Court who have more national security experience than Merrick Garland? And the only one I could think of was Michael Chertoff, right? Mm-hmm. Who's also been a circuit court judge. People forget that he served on the Third Circuit. I mean, you know, but who were sort of jurists of repute, who also have very substantial national security experience. That's a really limited universe of people. And so I think it's an interesting needle threading by the president. I'm sure not a conscious feature of his decision making, but one that I think makes Garland kind of qualitatively different from any other nominee in the last 20 years or so, maybe more.
Just one thing I wonder is if it is a conscious factor in his decision making. This choice signals to me that the president, you wouldn't nominate this person if you didn't think you could live with him, right? Because, I mean, the last thing you want is the Republicans to call your bluff and nominate someone you actually didn't want. Signals that he's pretty confident Hillary Clinton is going to be president, because he's not taking the opportunity even just to make a stand and nominate a very liberal judge or nominate like a Sri Srinivasan or someone like this. I think he knows that Hillary Clinton's going to come along and have the chance to nominate three possibly justices in the next 4 years, right?
Right.
And fundamentally, like, reshape the face of the court. And
well,
that,
it's either that or it's a judgment.
He couldn't do that with this
one, nomination is one of the things he can do to make it more likely.
Yes.
That she will win.
Or honestly, there's even
it's a great get out of the vote effort. Yeah.
Like a more honest reason for the selection, and that is just that he agrees with Garland, right? So,
yeah.
So the reason that Garland is a moderate is not necessarily because he kind of splits the baby on all of the issues, but because his alignment is sort of, you know, relatively progressive on social issues, maybe more favorable towards the government on issues related to the Fourth Amendment, you know, scope of privacy, certainly standing. I would actually argue that if Barack Obama had to sort of put down his actual beliefs in the various outcomes of cases based on his interpretation of the law, as opposed to just sort of his pure ideology, I think maybe he would agree with Garland on a lot of these issues.
Right.
So well, and to sort of emphasize that theme of sincerity, which I think is appropriate, even though we're in a very political season and we can be very cynical, despite the meat grinder that this nominee has just been dropped into in a partisan sense, it was really moving to watch the announcement and to see Garland, you know, go up to the podium and say, this is the greatest honor of my life.
Oh, he was choked up. He was really choked up.
He was moved. The gravity of the occasion, mm-hmm. you know, that component of our system, it's still the most respected institution of government in the United States.
Except the military.
Right. But, you know, among the three branches, it's head and shoulders above the other two with the American public. And so it was just so wonderful in the midst of all this hilarity and inanity and misery of the political season to have this one moment that was really quite sincere and profound and important and moving.
I just want to pick up on Susan's point. You know, I think if you're the president, whether you're a left president or a right president, there are certain things that you have to do. And a lot of them implicate the national security space. And so the problem for a lefty president is that some of the things that you have to do and that you come to believe are appropriate for you to do are not exactly consistent with the ideology of the political movement that you come from or that you may believe yourself. And, you know, Obama is somebody who has a civil libertarian soul, but he's also gets the intelligence briefings every morning. Mm. And, you know, he needs a Supreme Court that reflects his philosophical views to the extent that he has the authority to make nominations. You want that. You want that as a legacy matter. But you also want a Supreme Court that's not going to tell you can't do all those things you need to do. A lot of them in the surveillance space, some of them, in Obama's case, in the detention space. And, you know, there's a value for somebody like that in somebody like, you know, a Merrick Garland, who is pretty hard-assed about that sort of thing. And, you know, even while there's no reason to think he won't be a part of a liberal bloc about, you know, conventional social divisive issues that we think about the Supreme Court as as riven by politics about. There's every reason to think he would be on the liberal side of those, but not in the sense of sort of disabling the presidency from, you know, in national security areas.
Okay, stay tuned. All right, next up, an American ISIS defector. There is one. He's a real person. He's a real boy.
A defector to ISIS?
A defector from ISIS.
Interesting.
An American ISIS defector from ISIS. So, 26-year-old Virginia man named Muhammad Jalal Qais. I believe he comes from a Palestinian-American family. At some point in the past several months, leaves his home in a leafy cul-de-sac in Northern Virginia, and makes stopovers in Europe, gets to Turkey, and goes across the border into Syria. As of late January, he's fighting with ISIS in Iraq, apparently decides he's had enough of that, hightails it out, and then is captured by Peshmerga forces earlier this week as he is leaving Mosul and trying to cross into Kurdish territory.
So is he a defector? Or is he a deserter who got caught?
Yeah, that was my question.
He's the Bo Bergdahl of ISIS. this is a bit of an unknown. But so a video emerged this week of this guy walking up to Peshmerga forces near Sinjar. They reportedly had seen him out on the line, started shooting at him. I guess he then identifies himself, comes up. And you can hear him talking, saying he's from the United States. You know, they're like, what are you doing here? He doesn't want to talk too much, doesn't want the cameras on. He's carrying Turkish currency, 3 cell phones, and a Virginia driver's license. And
I'm also carrying all those things.
Yeah. Totally. So apparently they don't confiscate your driver's license when you're in ISIS.
Because they may need you to drive one of those captured jeeps.
And... Right, exactly. Well, this made me wonder, too. So this brought up a number of questions, the first of which was, you know, is the United States going to try and get this guy back? It does not appear to be a matter of much urgency in the State Department or the Justice Department.
Hell
my reporting
of a punishment,
suggests.
Right? So, yeah.
There's a precedence for this, right? I mean, there was a Supreme Court case on this, right, where there was a guy who was a U.S. person who was in Iraq, and he didn't he like file a habeas petition or something, and he wanted to come back.
So
and they said, "No, so sorry, you're in Iraq. Bye bye."
Yes, there have been a number of such cases. Not all of them. I'm not sure which one you're talking about. There have been a number of cases in which people have alleged that the U.S. government is sort of constructively responsible for their detention. The courts have not had a lot of time for that idea.
So it appears that he's, at least for the time being, Munaf V. Garin.
Oh, yes.
Okay.
That is... slightly different issue.
Okay, slightly different. But there appears to be no real urgency to get him back. It's not clear whether he's being interrogated by U.S. authorities. The Kurds say they are interrogating him. You would think that this person would have, you know, some pretty compelling information.
But
to
he
provide.
Wasn't with them very long.
Not with them very long, which leads to me to like the more interesting story here mm-hmm. in this, I think, which is that there is anecdotal evidence, if you kind of talk to people in the military and intelligence community, that ISIS defections slash desertions are up,
mm-hmm. yes.
that they're losing territory. It's actually getting harder to bring recruits in because a lot of the crossing points in Turkey are being locked down.
And because we blew up all of their money.
And because we blew the shit out of their cash. They've had to cut salaries. They've had to raise taxes. They've had to raise prices for services. And there's
and
this
they've gained a little bit of a reputation for putting their new foreign recruits on the front lines as cannon fodder, isn't
right,
that right?
Right. So you got to wonder, like, did this guy show up here and say, like, this isn't at all what I signed up
this
for.
This is not fun.
This is not what I thought.
This was going to
this
be
is
fun.
Not what you promised it's me nuts. In the cat video, which they use, by the way. And it just, it really, I mean, it's there's the obviously very interesting legal slash diplomatic issue of what do you now do when there's a U.S. citizen, the first American ISIS fighter to be captured on the battlefield. So mm-hmm. he has that dubious distinction. But what, you know, does this signal that there's some kind of cracks in their recruitment strategy? And if that's true, and they are losing territory, according to a study I just saw that Jane's put out this morning, I mean, it leads to the question, like, are these positive signs? People are leaving the ranks. The supply lines are being cut. I mean, hey, the Russians, not that the Russians were actually attacking ISIS, but they're pulling out of Syria. I don't know. I mean,
Well, so it goes back to what do we understand ISIS's business model to be,
yeah.
okay? And so we had this assumption. Of course, we know how they emerged. They emerged from a sort of insurgent movement that didn't rely on a territorial base. But then we had this model of them as a movement that cared a lot about governance, about mm-hmm. holding territory, having population under their control, raising revenue, providing services. And then after the Paris attacks, I think that model, analysts started rethinking that model. And ISIS started speaking, the ISIS leadership started speaking more about its broader objectives beyond sort of the creation of this territorial entity, this caliphate. And so, I you know, you can look at it and say, well, it's clearly a blow to the territorial component of ISIS, but does it signal that they are on the road to defeat? Well, part of the problem is that we've never really understood, and certainly none of the governments in the anti-ISIS coalition have articulated what defeat means
right.
or what it looks like, because we don't yet have a clear handle on what this movement is actually about.
You guys think that the U.S. government should try to get him back? I mean, as a matter of principle, I mean, should we allow you, or should we say, no, you turned your back on your country, you went to fight with a foreign terrorist group that's declared, you know, war against us, that we're essentially in combat with. You are on another country's soil. They are engaged in a military conflict with them. Not, granted, you know, a non-state actor, but I mean, let the Iraqis try him,
yeah,
right?
But look, I certainly don't think that we should not try and get someone back as a punitive measure, right? So sort of, I mean, all joking and laughing aside about that, right? Like, the law really should dictate here.
And he may have made just a gigantic mistake.
Right. Yeah. I think the question the United States has to ask are, you know, what are sort of the sovereignty considerations? What are the implications to our national security to the extent we attempt to assert legal authority here?
Is there intelligence value in trying to get him back or not?
Exactly. You know, what are the odds? What's going to happen if he comes back? Is this going to be something that's tribal in federal court? Is this going to be, you know, the non-Guantanamo, whatever the sort of the next thing is going to be? You know, so I think all of those interests have to be considered, and I think it's reasonable. I don't think that there's
but
some
none
sort
of those
of...
are principled, because none of those are responsive to Shane's question. Shane's question is, as a matter of principle, should we take the view that when one of our people
goes and fights for an enemy, we should get them back?
Right.
What's the principle?
I think the answer to that is there's no principle. I think there may be prudential reasons why you'd want to get him back and deal with him yourself, like that you trust your people more than you trust the Peshmerga. To the extent he's being abused, you probably have, you know, consular obligations to protect your people. But I don't think we have I don't think there's any obligation on the part of the State Department to spend energy advocating for the repatriation of an American who signs up with enemy forces
But what you're talking about is you're still talking about prudential concerns, not principled ones, because there has to be at least some underlying principle that whenever somebody violates federal statute, the reason we have these statutes is because we believe that whenever the part of justice is whenever someone violates one of our laws, we want to prosecute them in our justice system.
No, but
there are all kinds of reasons why we don't, why as a discretionary matter we don't do that, but I think that has to be the animating principle.
I don't think so. I think when somebody commits a crime, you have the option of prosecuting them in your justice system. That's an option available to you. You also have the option of deferring to the jurisdiction in which the crime took place, which in this case is the battle took place, and which in this case would mean deferring to the Kurds.
Let's flip this around for a minute, though. What if it's not a question of the U.S. asserting a principle that it wants to try its own people? And rather, you know, the state that this guy went to cause harm there, saying to us, he's your problem. This is your mess. You shouldn't have let him ever get here. And you're the one who has to clean it up.
Well, that's the Guantanamo situation where we have the people and we try to get their home states to take responsibility for them. Now, I certainly think if the Kurds want us to take responsibility for him, we should.
Yeah.
But Shane's question is, do we have some great interest in taking him ourselves? And to me, the other analog to this is, you know, if you're a U.S. person, say, who disappears in Iran and the Iranian government is holding, the United States takes a very strong position that we will advocate for our people to get U.S. people repatriated. I think if you sign up for the Iranian Revolutionary Guard, however, and you end up fighting in Syria and getting, you know, arrested by, you know, moderate Syrian rebels and held, I don't think we have a great consular interest in your repatriation at that point.
Yeah.
So that's one vote for let him rot.
Let him rot.
It also, I mean, I could articulate this sort of the political message argument, which is
clarifying, boiling it down.
Yeah, right. Ben, let him rot with us. There you go. That's the guiding principle.
But doing that presumably would also be a very effective message to send to would-be American ISIS recruits.
Absolutely.
Saying
not.
You go over there, don't come crying back to mommy and daddy and saying you want to be tried by
own.
You're on your own, pal.
Yeah,
and you can spend 30 years in a Kurdish prison and see how you like it. That sounds like a line from Airplane. You ever spent time in a Kurdish prison? That's the new counter social messaging strategy.
Exactly.
Put that on Twitter. Like, you want to spend some time in a Kurdish prison?
Joey, have you ever been in a Turkish prison?
All right. Well, have fun in prison, Jamal. Let's see. So this week, disturbing news. If you have been visiting New York Times,
New York Times, MSN, BBC, and AOL.
AOL. Who? What? That was a website once.
They.
Then you too may be infected with ransomware.
You may indeed.
It was ransomware?
So.
But not Lawfare.
But not Lawfare. And maybe not if you visited from a Mac. That was a separate incident. But yeah, so the evidence has now emerged over the weekend. Anyone who visited these sites potentially interacted with malware, ransomware malware that came through third-party ads. And so these are, advertisements that the New York Times just basically contracts out, doesn't have a ton of control over what is delivered. It's a very lucrative and attractive cybersecurity threat vector, essentially. So my question on this is one, let's all make sure we've backed up our hard drives if we visited any of these sites. And two, this like really interesting question about sort of third-party ads is emerging right now. Wired.com has recently elected to ban ad blockers. So ad blockers are the software that a lot of cybersecurity experts say everyone should be using, these features to ensure that you don't interact with these ads. The problem is that's the way websites make money. And sort of as journalism moves to an online platform, as we're sort of we're seeing more emerging voices, they're saying, well, wait a minute, this is how we make money. And so my question, I think, is just a really sort of interesting clash of cybersecurity values and potentially First Amendment values. I have security experts in the room. I have a journalist in the room. What do you think?
Well, I certainly am sympathetic to Wired's position on ad blockers. I'm not advocating one for the Daily Beast. And actually, I don't know if we do or don't allow them.
We
do allow them? Okay.
I know, because I go and I block your ads.
You block the shit out of those ads. That's, and we should say, like, it's like the little blue box that shows up in the corner of the ad that lets you block. You're talking about an overall blocker.
No. This
installed.
Is like an ad blocker that you use on your computer.
You got one installed. Because
right?
Sometimes you can close
your stuff
the individual
and I don't
ads.
Pay for it.
Okay. Well, thanks.
I do read your
thanks.
Stuff. All
yeah.
of it.
My cats appreciate that, and my mortgage does too. But no, I mean, I'm sympathetic to it because, I mean, look, I mean, none of us have figured out the revenue model, and I've been in this business 17 years today. Actually, it's my anniversary.
Yay.
In journalism.
Happy anniversary!
Thank you. And I've never had a moment in this business where anyone has a freaking clue about what the actual revenue model is and how the business is going to work. That said, I do think it's, to some degree, isn't it incumbent upon publishers to make sure that their ads are not feeding
right.
viruses to
if
people?
You're infecting
and there are ways,
computers.
By the way, for companies to find that out. I mean,
right.
This is actually a very productive and growing segment of the cybersecurity industry is people who look for adware and ransomware and find it in these places that are being delivered up to people without their knowledge. And, you know, companies probably have an obligation, I think, or at least, you know, a duty to readers to try and root that stuff
and,
out.
And if they don't, I mean, it seems to me that this is a problem that the free market can deal with pretty easily because companies should do that if they're smart. If they don't, people will learn to avoid their sites for fear of malware. And in fact, I went on the New York Times site this weekend on my phone and I got this weird pop-up asking me to interact, and I couldn't make it go away, and I sure as hell wasn't going to click OK. Mm. So I even uninstalled Chrome from my phone to get rid of it.
Wow.
See, excellent cybersecurity practices.
Thank you.
Round of applause for Tammy.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you. Thank
nice.
You. I'm an educated consumer, but the point is educated consumers will move away from websites that can't guarantee their safety. And so either they will find some other way of generating revenue that doesn't open up this threat, or they will find ways of reassuring users that they've taken care of this
threat. Doesn't that just mean big, giant companies like the New York Times are going to be able to have secure sites, and then sites that are less able to invest in that kind of practices, right, sort of things that that give alternative voices are going to be...
Well, but I think there's an antecedent question here, which is... whether there's civil liability for a site that's feeding you malware.
Sure.
You know, so when you, well, it's not, you know, when you use software, there's no liability to the software companies, even if that software jumps out of the computer and bites you and, you know, draws blood. And the question is...
Internet of Things.
Exactly.
The Internet of Vampire Things.
This is the cyber version of the hot McDonald's coffee.
Exactly. Yeah. And so here's... I think one possibility is that the New York Times is not a software provider. It's a website. And I don't. It would be interesting to look at their terms of service as to the terms of, as to what you're immunizing them against. Mm. And I suspect you're not immunizing against them against, you know, them being a platform for
malware that eats your computer.
For malware distribution that eats your computer. Now, interesting question: whether Congress has immunized them for that in Communications Decency Act. But I think there's an interesting antecedent question here as to whether the right answer to this is for somebody to sue the crap out of them. And by the way, sue the crap out of the advertisers too. You know, the advertising agencies, which are the direct propagators.
Right.
But is the important thing serving it, or is it circumventing the protection, right? So the real controversy is not just about using third-party ads. It's about sites that ban ad blockers. So they actually are forcing you to not use the protection.
Yeah. Right. So no. But my point is, you could address the problem. It's possible to imagine addressing the problem of these, you know, the cybersecurity dangers without choosing between without choosing to use ad blockers if the civil liability regime were properly situated. I agree with you. There's this other issue, which is, hey, some people don't want to see ads and some people don't want to engage these third-party servers. They do want to read the Daily Beast or the New York Times. So is it appropriate for Wired to be, you know, basically blocking people from making that choice? But I'm not sure that the choice is quite as stark as the cybersecurity versus First Amendment values that you're describing, because there is this intermediate possibility. You know, fine, let them serve ads, but understand that they're civilly liable if they screw up your computer.
I like that. I think that's a good free market solution.
I'm not advocating that anyone test this with my employer.
Go to Daily Beast, read their ads,
and then
click
sue
on them.
Get infected, sue people. Oh, God.
That's what Trump would advocate. Just sue him.
Oh, he would totally advocate that. By the way, there's
not
this,
him, though.
Right.
There's this great Trump-Hamilton sketch by this comedy troupe at Brown that's on the internet now, by the way.
Oh, no, I got to find that.
You got to find that. Just run to it. Trump-Hamilton, find it. All right, let's go on to object lessons. Ben, do you want to go first?
Well, my object lesson, as promised last week, when my object lesson was a car to go pick up a puppy, we drove 1,500 miles in 2 days, which I have never done before, to rural Kentucky, where I have never been before, to pick up a puppy. We drove back with the puppy. And the
everyone lived to tell the tale.
Everyone lived to tell the tale. The puppy, as you can see, if you go to our show page, here he is.
He's very sweet.
He's mighty cute. The older dog is quite annoyed by his presence, growls at him.
As is his prerogative.
Yes.
Now we're all back. So my object lesson on the theory that puppies calm everybody down is a puppy.
Very cute puppy, too.
Who should we send puppies to this year to calm them down?
Rubio.
Marco Rubio
could use a puppy.
Marco Rubio
could use a
dog.
He could use a puppy for sure.
Do you want a friend in Washington?
Yeah, get a dog. He might need like a litter of dogs. Did you see? Oh,
I don't know that he needs a friend
crushed.
In Washington anymore.
Yeah, okay. Susan.
Speaking of calming people down, I'm going to rile people up with my object lesson, which is this article, Terror Threat, Entire Washington, D.C. Metro System to Shut Down for 29 Hours.
Oh,
any minute
God,
for,
we didn't
quote,
talk about this.
Emergency equipment inspection. So this is from sort of like a kind of, let's say, conspiracy-minded internet publication.
I suppose it was inevitable.
By Frank Zappa.
Right. These are, right, but as you may or may not be be aware, the entire DC metro system shut down rather unexpectedly.
Right. If you were living under a rock, you might not be aware that Washingtonians have been cranky
it's
about it.
It's kind of
this.
A big deal.
So, one, the inevitable conspiracy theories, right, of, oh, you had some sort of credible threat. The FBI has said this is not the case. But two, the question
yeah, a credible threat that the frickin' metro is going to catch on fire.
So this is my whole point, right? Like, does it really make a difference? Like, we're talking about the whole metro catching on fire because, like, these huge electrical wires apparently have no insulation. They found 3 points of, like, major immediate failure.
I was just like, we could never have done this.
Right, so, like, the funny focus on, like, the sort of the over focus on the notion of this is a terrorist threat versus the notion of actually crumbling infrastructure is itself a relatively serious threat to public safety. I did not come into the office yesterday. I don't know if either of you.
I did not go into the office yesterday.
Shane? I don't use Metro, so I didn't have that problem. Yeah.
City
and
dwelling.
Ben just segued in.
Yeah. No. I drove to Charlottesville yesterday.
Oh, right. Okay.
He got out of Dodge.
But not on the Segway.
Tomorrow.
Okay. Well, my object lesson is a PDF that popped up yesterday evening or this morning on the New York Times.
Last night on the New York Times website.
Which is a transcript of Bo Bergdahl's interrogation by the U.S. military after his return to U.S. custody. I haven't read it yet. I have to admit that I'm very curious, both because, mostly because I think his motivations are still such a mystery to me. And it may just be that he was unbalanced, but I have perused it.
I haven't read it. It's a very long document. Mm-hmm. I've sort of perused it. I think it speaks to the notion that there is clearly some kind of unbalanced or mental, like, to the extent, and
previously diagnosed.
Right. Apparently, his attorney, Shane, you're nodding. His attorney released these documents.
Yeah, Eugene Fidel, who's his attorney, released these. The Times, I guess, have been trying to get them through a FOIA request, and he released it. It looks in part to point out that the Army knowingly enlisted this guy when they knew that he had had a previous mental condition that got him kicked out of the Coast Guard.
Wow.
And so raising the question of whether or not they should have done that. And pointing out, too, that nowhere in this 300-page-plus transcript is it ever contemplated that he would be charged with misbehavior before the enemy, which is the most serious charge that he faces. Mm-hmm. So great example of, like, your lawyer, like, doing some pretty good, like, public lawyering, I think.
PR lawyering.
Yeah.
It's an interesting move. We'll see how that and then, of course, the serial coverage ultimately impacts the case because these are some risky strategic moves that are being made.
Yeah.
I interviewed Eugene Fidel on a totally different thing like a month ago, and I said, hey, you watching the serial podcast? He's like, I don't talk about it. I'm like, now I know. You were. Waiting. Oh, episode 8 is coming? Boom! Here's the transcript. You know, here we go. So my object actually is a letter, also in a PDF form, from the acting secretary of the Army to Senator Mark Warner, informing him of an update in a story I think I've talked about on the podcast before. Stephanie Rader, who was the 100-year-old OSS precursor to the CIA veteran who had been trying to get the Legion of Merit, or her friends had been trying to get it for her. She died recently. It'll be a posthumous award if it happens. But the update is, as Secretary of the Army informed the Senator, that he has directed the Deputy Chief of Staff for Personnel, who is the person in charge of such things, to open a full and thorough review of her case.
Wow.
And so basically they're going to go back through it. This whole process has been hard by the fact that Stephanie's records, many of them were destroyed in this very famous fire at the National Archives in the 1970s, which wiped out a whole slew of World War II veterans' records, including my grandfather's, it turns out. It looks like Stephanie Rader is one step closer to getting her Legion of Merit.
That's a nice story. Like, it's important to go back and recognize the contributions of women.
Yeah, totally. And especially because in this case, it looks like the evidence is pretty significant that she may have been overlooked or denied the Legion of Merit because she was a woman. Uh-huh. And also because she was in the OSS, which back then, we forget, was this sort of upstart intelligence group in the military looked at and said, what is this? And how could you possibly be doing anything that would be worthy of...
Julia Child.
And I think they were maybe friends.
I think that definitely ups the cool factor.
Totally.
For sure. Definitely.
Totally. Anyway, Stephanie Rader, you're one step closer. All right. That brings us to the end of the show. Rational Security is a production of Spaghetti on the Wall Productions, and you can find our show archive at spaghettionthewallproductions.com. Please download the podcast and leave us a rating and a review. It helps to spread the word. You can follow us on Twitter at RATL Security. Thanks for all of your great tweets this week and all weeks. It's really helpful. We love hearing from you guys. The show is edited by Jen Howell. Our music was performed this week by Frank Gaffney and the Mad Blockers.
The Mad Blockers or the Ad Blockers?
No, the Mad Blockers.
The Mad Blockers, yeah.
Like they're mad.
Got it. Got it.
You got it. You got it. You've had a long trip. It's okay.
Yeah.
Been a lot of driving.
It's a little
lately.
Slow today.
Yeah. No, of course, our music was performed by Sophia Yan.
And the maybe, ad blockers.
And the ad blockers. And yeah, maybe your puppy plays piano. Have you asked? Maybe the puppy could be the...
He does have very long toes.
We gotta give it a try. We got to get the puppy together with our rational security listening dog.
Yeah.
In Austin,
yeah.
Texas.
Oh, that's right. They need to become our new show avatar. Ooh,
by the way, a gentleman approached me at the last Hoover book soiree and said, you know that guy who approached you in Texas whose dog listens to the show? And I said, yeah, that's my cousin.
Whoa,
wow.
Really?
Yeah.
It's a family business.
It's a family
the
business.
The rational security.
So I was moved. We have like this extended.
Does he have a dog?
I didn't ask.
You, like
you need to get him a dog and make it listen to the podcast. Things
so
work
we have
better.
A whole family of people
dogs
and dogs listening.
Listening
to
yeah,
the podcast.
That's great.
If you are a dog, please download and rate the podcast. Follow us on Twitter. On behalf of my friends Ben Wittes, Tamara Kaufman Wittes, and Susan Hennessy, I'm Shane Harris. We will talk to you next week. Thanks for listening.